Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, you're welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing food and nutrition security in Southern Africa. Joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Lola Castro, the Regional Director for Southern Africa at the World Food Programme, and from the capital of Botswana, Harare, is Duncan David Samikwa, Senior Program Officer for Food Security and Agriculture with the Southern African Development Community, or SADC. I have to say that Rola and Duncan, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. A pleasure for us as well.
You're most welcome. And of course, the feeling is mutual. Now, let me come to you immediately, Rola Castro, who probably doesn't have any relationship with the Castro brothers. You know, as my friend, colleague Paul Leo earlier said, I think that here at Straight Talk Africa, we owe you congratulations. And we are talking about the World Food Program as an agency having won the most coveted prize. We are talking about the Nobel Peace Prize for 2020. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. And we are really humbled and honored. And I must say, I mean, it's for all of us. It's not only for World Food Programme. It's for all those NGOs, all those UN agencies, all those partners, all those colleagues, governments that work with us. And especially, I must say, it is very special for all our colleagues in the field that are almost 20,000 in the deep field as well, in very remote locations in the world. So they are the happy ones on this prize. Thank you very much for that.
No, you're most welcome. How much of it did you, by the way, contribute? I am talking about the Southern African, you know, work that you are doing. How much of that part of that important contribution?
We hope we were a big important part of this contribution because we are one of the six regions that WFP has in the world. So, and in this region we have very many problems, especially in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mozambique, where the link between hunger and conflict is very evident. And as you know, it's very clear that hunger and conflict are a vicious cycle. Let's say, sometimes the hunger is the one originating the conflict. It starts by dispute of land, dispute on food, etc., and there is violence, and then it becomes conflict. In other times, you have, in fact, the conflict, what the consequences of the conflict will be people displaced, people moving out, leaving their harvests, their houses, having to go somewhere else, and being really hungry and food insecure. So if you want, the interlinkages are very clear. And in our region, unfortunately, Eastern Congo, as you very well know, has been in that situation for many years, since the 90s. And recently, unfortunately, we're seeing in northern Mozambique, in Cabo Delgado, this happening. And World Food Program, obviously, we work in these two areas with our professionals in the ground, with the government authorities, the NGOs, the civil society, the communities, to try to alleviate that hunger and ensure that people don't suffer and at least that they have minimum livelihoods. So I will say that in Southern Africa we have also very much contributed, because every single WFP staff member, every single WFP program where we are and partners, we have all contributed to it. It's about all the years we have been working on that. Since 1961, WFP is on the ground doing this. So if you want, we all assume that we are all part of the Nobel Prize winning.
Very interesting. Let me check out how much of the public relations you have actually done. Duncan, to what extent would you say that when the World Food Program won the big one, that people, for example, in Havarone, people in Botswana, knew exactly what was going on? And if they did, what was the reaction?
Thank you, Shaka. It was quite a pleasure for WFP to win this prestigious prize. When we had it, of course, at an individual level, I was very happy, and people around me, having worked a bit for WFP, but at the SADC level, I think the first thing that our office did is the ES sent a letter of congratulations to WFP. And it happened a couple of weeks after we had just had a meeting following up on a memorandum of understanding we had just signed with WFP. We had been discussing action plan on working together as the two organizations. So we feel part of the WFP, we are proud of the achievement.
Very interesting. Rona, what is the mission of the World Food Program?
Yeah, our mission, in fact, Shaka, is really very wide. But we can say we are the United Nations agency mandated to stop hunger or to achieve zero hunger, obviously, together with other colleagues, UN agencies like FAO and IFAD. We're also in Rome, like us, in fact. We're all based in Rome. But basically, you will see World Food Program shining at its best when there are basically conflicts, floods, cyclones like the ones we saw in Mozambique and Zimbabwe and Malawi last year, the Idai and the Kenneth. When there is distress in the communities, droughts, we will be trying to really alleviate that hunger through participating and working with the communities and government and civil society to ensure that the people can eat every day and they don't go into very many problems like nutritional, the children have nutritional problems, the community has to take special negative mechanisms to survive. So that's one part. The second part we do, and we do a lot more of that, is to really work, for example, with the smallholder farmers to ensure that they produce more and they access the markets so that there is sustainable food security in the communities. And in Africa especially, we're doing so much more of building resilience. We know the climate change is here, and it's here to stay. And it's affecting everybody. Southern Africa depends mostly on maize harvest. And I'm sure Duncan will give you more details later on how the maize harvest is affected by it rains less or it rains later, and how many people then are affected and cannot sustain themselves on a daily basis. So basically, World Food Program will be there also, working with those communities and governments and authorities locally and nationally to ensure that there are assets built like ponds, like gardens, like reforestation, like irrigation systems, which will ensure these communities will have a longer-term food security. So basically, we do everything around food security, from emergencies to development, and it's basically to reduce hunger and to reach, to have this world out of hungry people. At this moment, as you know, 700 million are going to bed without eating adequate meals, of without having an adequate food every day. So really very worrisome, and it's just getting worse, Shaka. That's the main problem. Yeah.
Very interesting. Duncan, SADC, the Southern African Development Community, is made up of 16 countries. And I'm sure that you have had the opportunity to pretty much, get a sense of what people feel in that important regional economic bloc. What extent do you find the average SADC citizen aware or conscious of the work, the great work, in fact, of the World Food Program?
Thank you very much for that question, Shaka. So out of the 16 member states, the feeling would differ from one to another because, like Aurora is going to admit, the presence of WFP is prominent in others where they've got large relief programs. And a bit less in the middle to higher income countries. So you talk about your South Africa, although they are based in Johannesburg, they don't have a big humanitarian program in Johannesburg, Botswana. But in the majority of the member states, WFP is a key partner, actually the lead agency in terms of humanitarian assistance. And because of that, they are so ubiquitous, everyone knows WFP and what they do. I would say that, Shaka.
Yeah. Laura, where do you have much presence in SADC countries? Are we talking about countries like, for example, Zimbabwe?
Yeah, definitely. We have 12 country offices, in fact, 12 countries where we have really a large presence, as Duncan very well said, in the SADC. And in some, we have very small presence because what we do, we have gone out of very big operations. Let me mention, for example, in Angola. Angola in the 90s, when there was a conflict, we had a very large operation. The largest operation in Africa for World Food Program was in Angola at that time. And then we scaled down and then reduced the office to a very small outlet. And now what we do is basically technical assistance with the government of Angola and other partners. SADC is very much involved on looking at vulnerability assessment. You mentioned, Shaka, Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, of course, is one of our large operations due to a number of areas like financial crisis, due to the drought, the recurring droughts related to climate change. So in Zimbabwe last year, we reached around 4 million people that were in need of food security. And, of course, government and NGOs reach more numbers as well. But DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, so we have large operations, as well as Mozambique as well. We have quite large operations related to drought, cyclones, and conflict. In Mozambique, if you look at the south, you have a drought. If you look at the central, you have the cyclone affected area of Manica and Sofala. And if you look at the north, you have the conflict in Cabo Delgado and surrounding provinces. So that's more or less what the big operations. But then we have very many operations, like we work a little bit with the government of Botswana on some food, nutritious foods, and we give technical assistance. We have a wide range, and as Duncan very well said, in some countries we are very prominent and we have large operations, in others not so, but we do a lot of technical assistance and recovery, if you want, support. Yeah.
What about the funding? Where do you get the bottom line from? Where do you get the money to run your operations?
Yeah, the World Food Program globally, for example, last year raised $8 billion. And we have over 100 million people around the world, around in 80 countries approximately. That's in general. In this region, we did around 17 million people. And basically, where does the money come from? I mean, there is different sources. You have first the governments. The governments of donor countries, we call them, but also the governments in the countries where we work, they also contribute. Like yesterday, for example, I was looking at the Republic of Congo, how they contributed 72 metric tons of salt to support the school feeding program in the Republic of Congo. School meals. There are over 200,000 children in very isolated areas in Congo where the government of Congo will put the salt and the donors will put the maize meal or the cassava and the beans and the oil. So there is a contribution by several actors. Another one will be the private sector. We get a lot from private sector, and we must not underestimate the individual giving. The individual giving is becoming very important. The individuals who feel like they can contribute to a better world, to a world without hunger, they do put a little bit, $1 or $2, and that $1 or $2 may have a meal, 2 days meal for a child in a school, or a nutritious meal in a health center for an undernourished child or a pregnant woman. So, you know, every contribution is valid, small or large. We have a wide range of donors, yeah, in fact, Shaka, yeah.
Historically, of course, since 1961, the World Food Program has really been known for working largely in conflict countries, conflict areas. To what extent has, for example, the recent floods connected to climate change and to the coronavirus pandemic affected that way of the World Food Program conducting its business?
Yeah, look, as you very well said, we work in conflict areas, and the countries in conflict, they make the largest number of people we support in the world, if you want. And this is why the Nobel Peace Prize is very much given to us, because that link, hunger and conflict, yeah, and how we avoid conflict by reducing hunger. But also we have worked over many years, especially in Southern Africa, you know, drought, El Nino comes almost every year now, doesn't rain, so drought's there. But like events like the freak incidents or cyclones we had 2019, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Comoros were heavily affected. So those cyclones left millions of people underwater, in fact. I mean, I went 1 week after the cyclone to Sofala and to Manica and to the Chimanimani in Zimbabwe, and that was a disaster. I mean, like, there were no villages. They had been inundated and disappeared under the mud. The fields disappeared under the mud. The people who had been over on the trees for some days, really, it was a really climatic shock. And what does WFP do the best? I mean, we mobilize our resources. We had bought food around the region. We had food in Zambia, in Malawi, in Durban. We moved it rapidly to those locations so that people didn't spend weeks without eating. No, it was in 1 month we reached 1 million people only in Mozambique after the cyclone hit. So that shows you that what we do, we really mobilize everybody, governments, donors, to support, and we move in to reach those people in very, very critical situations. But then, as you ask, and let me try to be concise because I'm sure Duncan can add some things here. When COVID hits and in the region, we've seen the lockdowns around end of March, South Africa locks down 26 March, and almost the whole SADC region has locked down. And there we were, I must say, very surprised. On COVID-19, we expected mostly a health crisis, but the effects on food security, Shaka, were massive. Look, all these urban areas where people couldn't go out on a daily basis to do their job and gain their small money to go to the market and buy their tomatoes, their beans, and their maize or rice, they couldn't access any funds, so they couldn't go to the market to buy any food. So we were called by 8 governments in the region almost immediately, like 2 weeks after lockdowns, to ask WFP, what can you do for the urban people? The urban people, in fact, were heavily affected. So we came in and with the governments and other actors like UNICEF and the World Bank and others, tried to put what we call shock responsive safety net. So really increase the transfers, the cash transfers, the people who are receiving cash transfers, to all those who suddenly couldn't work and couldn't even go to the supermarket or the small shop in the corner to a spaza shop or the small market to buy the minimum diet. So that has been a big job we have done during this. So urban transfers, cash transfers has been very critical, yeah, in this COVID. And we have been extremely busy and we continue being very busy on that. And very concerning also, if I may, just to end this topic that you mentioned, is the impact of COVID not only on the urban areas, but also in rural areas for smallholder farmers who couldn't sell their product, or if they had their small production, these women smallholder farmers, they couldn't access the market because transport was not there. So that very worrisome, because they are the source of food for this region, all these smallholder farmers across the region. So we really need to make sure that they continue producing and continue selling into the market. So we have been working on that as well, very much with SADC and with many other actors. Yeah.
Very interesting. To what extent, Duncan, would you agree with Laura that the crisis brought about by the coronavirus pandemic in the region, and of course the climate change, that you have suddenly seen the work of an agency such as the World Food Programme increase around wherever you move around the SADC region?
I wish to agree with everything Laura has just said. Even before the coronavirus took root in the region, we had done an assessment. We do an annual assessment of the status of vulnerability and food insecurity in the region. Mm-hmm. We had already estimated that we are 45 million people. That's about 12% of the regional population are food insecure. Now, when the virus hit and was taking root in the region, it meant that the supply chain, fortunately, it came at the time when harvesting was happening already in many countries. So the crop had matured and was ready for harvesting. But it now affected, like Laura said, because of the lockdown, the containment measures, there was that shock and break before member states and SADC decided to categorize sectors of the economy to say these ones are essential, they can continue working. But it wasn't immediate. So we experienced a lot of post-harvest losses because there was no labor movement to go and harvest. We couldn't even take some of the produce to the market. The farmers, like Laura said, they couldn't get cash because they depend on selling and then buying their provisions. Schools were closed. So we had a number of programs which were immediately affected because of that shock. And it increased the need for agencies like WFP working with the state governments to come and assist, because one of the things that happened was that governments shut schools, and we have a lot of programs, school feeding programs, where our children, up to adolescents, they rely on school meals. That was suddenly curtailed. So we needed to find a way of still providing that so that we don't compound the malnutrition problems. So I would say immediately, when the necessary containment measures came in, the work led by WFP and others was multiplied. Even for governments, the challenge was we needed to expand the social protection, both in terms of coverage and the length, duration, how long you're going to run, because the majority of urban population, like you said, they rely on piece works. You work for a few cents a day. As you going home, you buy food. That was suddenly shut. How do they get food? So it had a lot of consequences, which WFP and others had to come in. Gender-based violence, for example. Mm-hmm. As people got frustrated sitting at home, they couldn't find income, also went on the increase.
If I heard you quickly, are you referring, for example, to the report that came out sometime this year in July, where you were able to identify at least 44.8 people facing food insecurity in the region?
Correct, Shaka. That's what I'm referring to. So this is an exercise that we do every year, and this year, like I said, by July we were already estimating, but when we're coming up with those numbers, we had not fully integrated the full impact of COVID. We're estimating that the numbers could go up to even 50 million as we speak because of the effects.
Really?
Yes.
How accurate, by the way, is your assessment? Because there are skeptics who are wondering, for example, about the sort of methodology that you use to arrive at such a very huge number. Could you walk us through some of the methodology that you are able to use in order to reach at that magic number of 44.8 million people?
Okay, so we have set up what we call National Vulnerability Assessment Committees, multi-sectoral committees with expertise from health, from agriculture, from climate change, food security experts, statisticians, and economists. So every year they sit and define the methodology. The key methodology that we use is quantitative surveys. So these are very rigorous surveys which we are open. We're so confident of them that we invite anyone who will give you data, invite anyone to look at them. This is what we've done. Please critique. Do you think we have gone wrong? So we do these surveys, take sample surveys statistically in the member states and go out and do the interviews and do the analysis. We also do ground truthing by triangulating. And then on top of that, in many member states these days, we have done the analysis. We come back and do the integrated phase classification for food security, which is that not our evidence, but takes the other evidence in the economy to try and prove our methodology that these figures are correct. So we've done reviews and reviews that have been done by independent people. I'm glad to say, Shaka, that our methodologies are very, very close to what you'd get in the reality. Both the consistency and the history behind it, you even use the statistics, the figures that have projections, you're not going to come far from where we find this. Mm-hmm. And the if you go on the ground, because our methodology tells you the area that has been affected, the limited number of people, categories of people affected, and if you are an agency that you want to test this, you go in those areas and you find that indeed these are the people that assist us. So we've generated so much confidence among governments and partners that they literally wait for these figures to come out and then start their humanitarian aid programs.
Duncan, I know for sure that the World Food Program had been in sponsoring that research and indeed that report. Who are the other players in this?
Okay, so we must first acknowledge our funders who have normally funded this program, the Department for International Development of the British government, and the Swiss Development Corporation, who have been sponsoring the program for quite some time. At the moment, moment, the capacity building and the implementation of the program is run through WFP. WFP is a team that is training capacity building the member states in how to run the methodology. And WFP, we are very happy with them because they are technically very good. They've done these assessments for a long time. Now, to answer your question specifically, we work with USAID's FuseNet, Farming Area Warning System. We work with the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. UNICEF play a big part in the nutritional assessments. And we've got NGOs, international NGOs like Save the Children, Oxfam, who provide capacity in the assessment of markets. Even in universities, academics play a part in terms of training member states and capacity building.
As I often say, time is not our best ally. We'll go for a break, and when we come back, we shall continue with the discussion. Don't go away. Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, and today we are discussing food security in Southern Africa. My distinguished guests are Rora Castro, Regional Director for Southern Africa at the World Food Programme, and Duncan David Samikwa, Senior Program Officer for Food Security and Agriculture with the Southern African Development Community. Duncan, if you were to talk to us from the deepest better part of the bottom of your Malawian heart and soul, did you or were you able to learn anything new during your research and during the compilation of the report? And if you did, what are some of the lessons that you learned that you could share with us?
Okay, Shaka, we learn something new every year. I think the past couple of years, what I've learned is the resilience of our people in the member states. Every year we come up with huge numbers, 39 to 45 million. It's not all the time that these people come up and assisted, but they carry on, they live, they struggle, yes, but they find a way of living and carrying on the next season. So that, Shaka, has always been a place of interest in my heart to say, I think probably in future, like Roy was saying, we should learn the resilience. How are they surviving and how can we better it? What more do we need to do so that we lessen the struggle? You see, the climate change and climate variability, they are getting knocked each and every year. For the past 5 years, we've only probably had one good season every year. So their resilience gets knocked every year. It becomes less and less and less. We should not wait until they are not able to stand before we intervene. So apart from learning the resilience, what I feel in my Malawian heart is that we can't wait any longer to try and do something about it, to stop the knocking down that the people get from the various contributing factors to food insecurity.
Very interesting. Laura, what about talking to us too from the deepest, the better part of the bottom of your Spanish heart and soul? Are there any remaining skeptics about climate change in the region, or do most people now believe that it is a science that you have to follow?
To be honest, if in this region there is still a skeptic on climate change, it's because the other have been here one day or 1 hour. Because if you stay 1 week, you can see the climate change in action immediately. Or if you are from the region, like I consider my heart is in this region, as Duncan said, 27 years coming back to this region in Malawi, Mozambique, and South Africa. So let me tell you, Shaka, look, all of us, we go to the villages, all of us, we go to the coastal areas, all of us, we move around this region. And you can see, as Duncan said, how people, you see how the maize wilts year on year because of drought. You see how the cyclones enter through that coastal area, low coastal areas of the lower lands of Mozambique, and went all the way to the Chimanimani Mountains, destroying the mountains and bringing them down. I mean, that's climate change. These are massive effects of the climate change that we are seeing physically every year, as Duncan say, but also every day. You see, when it rains, it doesn't rain anymore, or nicely and peacefully, so that the maize will grow and it will rain on time. No, it rains so much that the seeds are washed away, or it doesn't rain at all, so it wilts. So also something very important, building resilience is critical. And building resilience is about changing some behaviors. We have this problem in Southern Africa. We are dependent on maize harvests. And the maize is very, very delicate to climate change. We really need to move here in this region in the past, before the maize was established hundreds of years ago. It came in from, obviously, America. They were small cereals, drought resistant. There was the cassava. There were all these type of crops that people were doing that will resist those shocks. Didn't rain, but it will grow. The millet, the sorghum, the small grains, we call them. And also the cassava is there. But we have lost that tradition. So to bring back those traditions is extremely important. So one of our jobs, SADC, WFP, FAO, and others, is to try to animate communities to diversify, to plant different things, to not to focus on one type of commodity crop, the maize, but to diversify and to make those crops that are resistant to tough weather more available so people can plant and people can consume them and they get used to it. I think that's extremely important because the climate change is here, not only now, but to stay and to be worst. So we have to get prepared. We have to prepare ourselves with the communities. And the governments are very conscious. The governments in this region, and SADC is leading through resilience frameworks and others. SADC is really leading the way to inform and to take actions, how to change that. So sorry, a bit long, but I'm very passionate on this topic, and really it's very, very critical in our region. Yeah.
Very interesting. Duncan, when you look at the conclusions and recommendations in your report, what specific measures do you recommend that needs to be adapted and adopted in order to address the outstanding issue of food insecurity in the region?
As a region, we are recommending several things. You know, as a region, we were sitting on probably one of the biggest water bodies around us, yet irrigation only covers 7% of our cultivable land in SADC. There is a challenge that most of the production is from smallholder farmers who grow less than 5 hectares. So probably to do large scale is difficult. But what we are recommending is, we are recommending now to move into community irrigation schemes for so that communities can grow twice a year. Maize, for example, which Lola talked about, 3-4 months you have a new crop. We can't continue relying on the erratic rain in SADC for production. That's one. The second issue is we need to build the resilience of our population. So we're recommending in there expansion of social protection, both in terms of numbers and the coverage. The reason we are pushing for this is that it's going to give people resources, income, enable to increase productivity. SADC, at the moment, we are one of the few regions with the lowest productivity. Our yields are very low. Our production is very low. Our population is growing. If you look at our production the past 5, 6, 7 years, it has remained static. The only thing that is growing is the population. So we need to improve. There's room to improve how we grow crops, how we find income and build communities. The third thing we are recommending is, of course, improvement of the value chains. So in SADC, most of our production is sold as primary commodities. So we export these commodities, harvest them, bag them, then sell them. We miss a lot of leverage on the way where we could go into agro-processing. By agro-processing, we bring in these hordes of youth that are looking for employment in marketing, in processing, in transportation. It's one of the easiest ways of increasing agricultural production. And the lastly, I want to talk about diversification. Laura is right on the mark. One of the challenges of our diets is cereal dense. It's just maize, very little vegetables and seasonal at that and salt. That's why our malnutrition is so high and stunting is so high in the region. So we are encouraging to go back to the traditional ways as well as diversify from just cereal-based diets. There are countries like DRC, which rely on cassava. Countries like Botswana, where I am, they used to rely so much on sorghum, which does well in this kind of climate, but we've shifted to maize probably because it was easier and cheaper to grow. But we need to go back and improve the way our nutrition and our production is done, Shaka.
Duncan, it is very interesting that you mentioned the sorghum because I come from Kabale, southwestern Uganda, where sorghum is one of the most important things that you cannot joke with. Sorghum, finger millet, and of course, maize.
Yes. Yeah. Very
interesting. Now, Duncan, let me take you back to the issue of production. You talked about how production is low. What have you been able to, what could you identify as the fundamental root causes of that, the fundamental root causes of production being low?
Okay, so Shaka, the fundamental roots is that one, as we've kept farming, like I said, our farming holdings are very small land holdings for the majority of the people, and they farm there year in, year out. Every year they are on there. So the soils have become very, very infertile. You put something in there coupled with the poor rainfall, then there's very little that comes out of that soil. As a region, we are the least region that uses fertilizers. So a combination of poor soils because of overgrowing, and you don't even have chance for fallowing so that it can regenerate, the soils need to be helped. So the region is working on its fertilizer policy to try and improve the production and productivity. We also are aware of the effects on climate change of inorganic fertilizers. So there are also large programs that the region is putting in place, what we call climate smart agriculture. How you grow that crop? In the past, many people would just monocrop, the soil, grow maize, and wait for it. But like you do in Uganda, Dr. Shaka, in one field you find three or four crops and they help each other. So it's those things that we're trying to push as a region to improve productivity. Just the way you plant maize, for example, if you follow the new methods of growing maize, you can increase three or four times the amount of harvest that we're getting in the region. The potential for maize, for example, is up to 8,000 to 10,000 tons. Commercial farmers in South Africa achieve that in some of these countries. But on average, our farmers, if you reach 2,000 tons per hectare, you've done well. So you can see the gap that is there. We must make sure that probably they may not reach 10,000 immediately, but we improve the production so that they should be closer to the potential of production. Use the same piece of land a bit more effectively.
Interesting. Laura, to what extent do you agree with Duncan's recommendations regarding the measures that need to be taken and must be taken in order to address the fierce urgency of food insecurity in the region?
No, I fully agree with the SADC assessment on the situation, and what he has said is very clear. All the different steps that he mentioned. Now, I just wanted to add maybe one that he mentioned, but just to add a little bit the gender lens in these things, because I think in this region we have a high potential women and youth that are working in the field. He mentioned how the youth needs to be re-engaged and really learning the new ways of farming and engaging. So fully agree. But also we know that the women are large producers. There are many of these smallholder farmers are women. And the women is very interesting because the women are not only producing for selling, but also when they produce and if they diversify their food production, they are also improving the nutrition of their family themselves. They are eating better at family level, and then they are also putting in the market a lot of different vegetables and cereals and pulses, etc., because women do a lot of vegetables and pulses as well, beans and other types, cowpeas, etc. So I think it's very interesting that we also add that the importance of women in Southern Africa and how we need to work with them more. And with welfare program, with SADC and others, with UN Women, we have been really very proactive trying to work with women smallholder farmers groups to give them the ability to reach the markets, basically training on financial literacy. So you know, you are putting so many kwachas or so many runs into the field and you are going to get so much out of it. And when you sell it, this is your benefit. So financial literacy, very important, so that it doesn't stay in the very small production, one bag or two bags, but they can increase. Also, helping them with the access to markets, with special apps like in Zambia, our team has been working with the government and farmers cooperatives so that they have an app that is in the phone, and they can say, okay, in this community we have put together 2,000 tons of cowpeas. So who wants to buy? And the buyers, they bid for it, and they come to the community and they collect it. So there is a lot of things we can do with the new technologies, as Duncan said, and also having the gender lens in the food security. For us, World Food Program, extremely important. Don't forget the women importance in at all levels of food security in this region. And I think SADC is working very strongly with the, on that, as Duncan very well said. So fully in agreement with Duncan.
Very interesting. How could anyone probably forget the significance of women in this business? Because the last time I checked, I think, in Africa, the women are the most important producers, really.
Exactly.
Yes.
I don't think anybody is forgetting, but we have to remind ourselves to make an extra effort.
Exactly.
I entirely agree. They are the most important producers. And just to add to what Roa said, we have a whole program at the SADC Secretariat, which makes sure that in every program that we come up with or any strategy guidance, we've put in that gender lens to bring out the full potential of contribution of women and the youth.
Perhaps we should go a little bit further than simply talking about how the women are the single most important producers. What about some who say that we really need a little bit of democracy here, because yes, the women can actually produce, which they do, but when it comes to control, that becomes an issue.
Absolutely, Shaka. So many I've noticed that many member states of SADC are changing even the basic land laws to now recognize the importance of women and ownership of land, because without access to these productive factors, they can produce, but they have no control. So you can't get credit, you can't make decisions about marketing. So these issues are very important, and we should always remember to put them on the table. Thank you very much for bringing it up, Shaq.
You're most welcome, Duncan. Now, Laura, let's talk a little bit about the vision thing. I realize, obviously, that you've been pretty much across the African continent. But when you moved to Johannesburg with the added responsibility of being the regional director of the World Food Program, surely you must have come with a vision. What was your vision when you came, and how far have you been able to accomplish that vision?
Yeah, for me, the vision, in fact, thank you for that question, Shaka, very, very important and very, very relevant for me and for my team and for all our partners as well. The first time I came to this region, as I told you, I was a very junior person, and I was working in Duncan's country, in Malawi, in Detsa. Detsa is a district that borders Mozambique, and at that moment, there were 145,000 Mozambicans from the Angonia, Tete province of Mozambique, in that district of Malawi. And my job was basically to ensure that they were food insecure while they were in refugees in Malawi. So if you want, why I'm saying this? Well, I'm saying this because I've seen this region for 27 years, no, at this moment. My vision when I came then to Jobur 4 years ago, well, I was very clear to say, look, if in 24 years the situation remains the same and is even worse, I would say, if you allow me, food security-wise, than when I was in that village or district capital in the border between Malawi and Mozambique, what does WFP need to do to support the governments and to work with, not to support, to work with and with the SADC and et cetera, to change something. And the conclusion for me is like, it cannot be business as usual, basically. We have been, as WFP maybe, too many years providing food assistance. And what we need to do is much more what Duncan said at the beginning. We need to know better and earlier what is going to be the problem. So this is why these assessments that he mentioned is important. So we need to know how many people will be food insecure. And then, most importantly, to act early, not just to provide food and transfers, but to build, to help these communities to build resilience, to ensure that they are not going to be during the lean season in November, December, January, February, again needing food, but they will be able to produce their own food. So basically to work more on community resilience, but early enough in the year, so people, not so many millions appear at the end of the year in every lean season, food insecure. So basically my vision was, let's try to reverse the trends of food insecurity by working more in a sustainable long-term manner and helping the communities to build their own capacities, what we have been discussing. So that's the in simple the vision. Because as Duncan said, we have many more citizens in the region, we have much more impact of the climate change, and the production is reducing and it's not enough. So a number of actions need to be put together. But if I can conclude, that one will has been my vision, and we are working towards it with all the partners. Yeah, thank you. Chuck.
You're most welcome, Rhoda, but talk to us about the collaboration between your agency, the World Food Programme, and SADC, the Southern African Development Community, and indeed the respective governments. How is the collaboration?
The collaboration is excellent. We meet with the Secretary tax frequently, and her team, here you have an example, Duncan, with an excellent partnership. And I will say maybe in four areas I think we have progressed a lot. One is this one of working together, technical assistance on the area of assessing what is the food insecurity in the region and what can be done to avert it. That's one. The other one is all the area of trade, logistics, movement of food and other ports and et cetera. There we have worked a lot, and we are really moving towards linking as well with the African free trade and really seeing how we can contribute.
Let me ask you the question about the report that you were able to compile. Is there any chance that in the spirit of African unity, that you share, that you compare and contrast with what is happening in Southern Africa, in SADC, with those of your colleagues in the East African Community and ECOWAS?
Yes. We publicize our report once it comes out. It's freely available on the internet, and we're moving a step further in the next few months, where we'll even be putting the data that we've used to compile the report, so that anyone who wants to do additional analysis or check the accuracy can work with the data that we used.
And for that, I have to say, frankly, once again, that I have been profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have had the opportunity to interact with both of you for the first time on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Southern Africa. And please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.